This episode of Hustle is brought to you by Design Inc., the best place to find creative talent. Need help with a project? Post it on Design Inc. and receive free proposals from the best designers, illustrators, and animators. Join the hundreds of companies and startups that have been connected with the perfect creative for their project. Go to designinc.com/hustle and start your project today.
Hey, welcome back to the Hustle Podcast. This is your host, Anthony Armendariz, and I'm back for another awesome conversation with a very talented designer. Today, I'm here with Grayson McAlpine, a friend of mine and a very talented designer from the Bay Area. She is traveling back and forth between Texas and was actually able to come and record with me in person, which is exciting because I don't normally get to do this. I think the last guest was Dan Petty. It's good to sit across from someone and talk with him. Grayson is a product designer formerly at Wayno, and she's now currently a freelancer on her own, building her own destiny, being her own boss. Grayson, why don't you say hello and tell us a little something about yourself?
Well, hi, and thanks for having me, Anthony. It's like really awesome to be here. So I'm currently living out in San Francisco, technically the East Bay, living out in Emeryville. Moved out there a little over a year ago to work with the Wayno team, and currently actually am freelancing, doing the whole contract freelance gig. I left Wayno, I want to say almost 2 weeks ago, to kind of pursue this. It's always been like on the back of my mind, on my heart, to just like go with, you know, my dream for running my own gig and kind of like running a company, honestly. So I decided to take the dive and pursue that. So I do product design, and that has been primarily my focus, but I'm also incredibly passionate about a lot of other things, and that's like photography, music. I've been very, very interested in also just working with nonprofits and building community, connecting with people, creating opportunities for people to connect. So that's something I just wanted to explore further and just kind of see where I could take that.
And you're also speaking at conferences.
I am, yeah. So my first talk was at ValioCon last year. I was still living in Texas at the time, and it was right before my transition to Wayno. And then I recently just spoke at Squares, so yeah.
So you got a lot going on. What kinds of things do you like? Let's talk about each one of these. What kinds of things do you like to design?
I love designing for mobile. And so when I first started out as like understanding like what product design was and starting out in that, I immediately dived into mobile. So I love designing those experiences. That would kind of like web applications as well. I really enjoy doing that. And I do like some like marketing design stuff. I may not be as like, you know, gung-ho about it, like, oh my God, I can't wait to design another website, and I'll do it, and I enjoy it, but I love mobile. I don't think I have an exact reason for why, but yeah, so.
If you had to have a reason why do you think?
Let's think. I think it's because, for me, it's something that somebody consistently returns to. It's an experience, you know? And so for me, like, being able to do everything that, you know, goes into understanding who I'm designing for and why and what they need, and then crafting that experience and pushing it out to them, and just, it's very like holistic in my opinion, and I love that. Love knowing that I'm contributing to helping someone, and also, I don't know, it feels personal to me. So I enjoy them.
Yeah, that's interesting. Mobile is also my favorite, but mm-hmm. for a different reason. I like mm-hmm. it because it forces you to think about, well, what's the one thing this has to do? And it doesn't, usually mm-hmm. not more complicated than like yeah. performing one very, very strong function. Mm-hmm. And you also do photography. So when you're in the office the other day, you said, oh, I got work to do. I got some projects to work on. And you used the photography. I actually didn't know that you did that kind of work.
I do, yeah. So it's so interesting to me because as I was telling you earlier, I kind of fell into design. Never knew that this would be my career prior to that. I was going to be a filmmaker. I loved storytelling, loved filmmaking and photography, so that whole visual medium. And so I really thought that was going to be my career, and I got very active in just developing that and experiencing all that I could. So photography was always like a hobby thing that I was doing, and I realized, like, dude, I'm just like passionate about people. So my favorite type of like expression of that is through portraiture and some like lifestyle photography. So I started to take that really seriously. Good grief. I'm really bad at dates, but I definitely, at least well over a year ago, where I was like, you know what, this is something I really want to focus more time in and grow in and have more opportunities to pursue. So I'm all about portraiture. So I love people.
So now that you're on your own,
yeah,
is photography a part of this business vision?
Yes.
That you have?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So yep. tell us what you're doing now.
Yeah.
I mean, what's the new venture going to be about?
Yeah. So this is something that I actually started prior to like transitioning to Weno, even a little bit before. You know, I was working remotely with two other agencies, and this was something that I had like a vision for that I wanted to do with other creatives, not necessarily designers. So basically, I started, and it's called Wild and Gray. I started this a little while ago, and again, like I said, put it on the sidelines, and now we're just basically a collective, a family of freelancers, essentially. And we have different focuses. So in the past, one of my team members, like, we did a lot of video work together and have, you know, shot a lot with photography as well. And another guy on my team, he's an amazing lettering artist, type designer, and does some brand. So I'm just wanting to cover a full spectrum of services. And people can contract us, you know, dependent on their needs. You know, they may only need video work. They may only need photography work. We've had an opportunity where they've been able to contract us out for more than one skill set. So last year I had the opportunity to work on a project for Waverly Labs, and they're a startup based in New York City. And basically we were working on their Kickstarter video. And that was a lot of fun, and they hired us to do that, and never expected that this would go massively viral, and they would raise, at this point, I think it's like over $4 million in funding, for their product. So it was like an incredible experience. We were so excited. And then after that, contracted again, to design their, first version of their app that would accompany their product. So that was like a really, really neat experience. So
I've had quite a few people on the show that run businesses, mm-hmm. and agencies and even freelancers, but I think you might be the first person that's been on the show that is self-employed but in a collective model.
Oh, yeah.
I actually don't even know how that works. I mean, is there anything you wanted to share about how that works, like in this collective that you guys have, like who does the biz dev, who, you know, do you guys share that? Like, how do you guys actually...
Yeah. So that's a really awesome question. And to be honest with you, like, I don't have all the answers. The reason why we chose this model, to pursue this model, was a bit more geared towards, you know, ease, you know, like, for instance, I didn't want to have to handle for the first time right off the bat, you know, operations and biz and all of that. Because as you know, as a contractor, you're already dealing with that on your own, you know, and that's a lot of work. So being able to kind of still, you know, do something under a brand name, you know, under that umbrella, and kind of create that brand value in the face of that identity, but, you know, stay contract where everybody can focus on that on their own, you know.
Yeah.
And currently, like, who knows, maybe 2 years down the road, I'll kind of shift focus. Maybe we'll become more of an agency model, and I'll have to start worrying about, you know, dealing with operations and all of that comes with running your own business in that format. But for now, like, this worked really well for us. And honestly, like, I think that I speak for the entirety of my team. Like, we're very, we love to travel and we love remote work, and we all have a very strong background in freelancing, you know? And so just, it kind of makes sense. And I think, even though I have definitely valued and appreciated and probably will continue to, you know, working in house with teams or working contract remotely, like, I love kind of calling my own shots and kind of exploring and experimenting and figuring out what I'm good at and what I love to do and just going with it. So
I love your outlook, because I think some people try to get it perfect, and it's never perfect, right? Like you said, like, you might do this, you might make this tweak later, you might do this later, and you're kind of figuring out. I think that's a really good approach, because if you wait for the right time or for everything to be perfect, then you're pretty much waiting forever. I know a lot of people that would have been or could be very, very good small business owners or freelancers, but can't seem to get there just because they can't take the first step.
Yeah.
So about that first step, I mean, I was going to ask you if it felt scary in some way that you're back on your own again, mm-hmm. but I wasn't aware that this is something that you were doing prior to having a job.
Yeah.
But why don't you share a little bit about how it feels to be in the, you know, especially in the Bay Area, to have the stability of a job and mm-hmm. now be solo.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrifying, but I love it. And I mean that, you know, we talked about this earlier, like I've never known what I'm doing ever, but it's about starting, you know, it doesn't like, you can't, like, especially for people who are uncertain or have never done this before, you're going to feel fear. You're going to feel uncertainty. You're going to wonder, you're going to second guess yourself, but that will continue to hold you back. Like, you just have to go, you just have to jump, and you learn along the way. And if you're an honest person, you stay transparent, you stay productive, you stay constructive, you stay curious, like you meet people, they support you, they give you insights, and you learn along the way. Like, that's my entire experience. You know, it's just learning along the way and being very, very aggressive about my learning, you know, and where it can take me. Yeah.
So in terms of learning, I mean, you're a relatively mm-hmm. young designer.
Yep.
I mean, I don't know if you want to, but if you do want to, why don't you share with people how long you've been a designer for?
Yeah, absolutely. So I didn't get serious about like what I do now, which is, I would probably identify that just for the sake of having a label as product design, until about 2 years ago. Prior to that, I was just kind of exploring like more of like the graphic design route, you know, illustrating yeah. and brand kind of stuff. And honestly, I was determined to be good at it, but sometimes it's not enough to be good at something. If you don't love it, why are you spending that time, investing that time? Yeah. And so I basically, thank God for the internet. I was just reading a lot of stuff and talking to people on Twitter. Like, Twitter is amazing. It's the best platform I've ever been on for engaging and connecting with people who know more than you do.
Yeah.
And so just having these conversations, I realized there's this thing called product design, which for me, it just meant people oriented. And so I realized that's what I want to do. I want to focus on people. I want to focus on experiences. And basically, I just plunged right into that. And of course, like, I had to focus also on like the visual design aspect, not just, you know, the process of like, you know, figuring out research methodologies and, you know, interviewing and user testing, all that stuff, but just like visual design. But anything that I wanted to know, I was going to figure out through a lot of trial and error, a lot of error, you know, but you embrace it. And so I've just been doing that for the past couple of years, and just, you just make shit, dude. You just, you grab any opportunity that you can to learn, and it doesn't matter whether it's perfect or not. You get insight, you get feedback, you keep making, you get better, and you never stop.
Yeah. The never stop part is the part that, that I'm scared of the most. And thank you for sharing that, by the way, before I get into me, let me
yeah, of course.
Say a few things about you. So, I know that Dribbble isn't everything, and I don't really mm-hmm. judge people by what I see on Dribbble, because I know there's a big delta between like what someone can show and can't show is, you know, I mean, a lot of things that we work on as designers, we can't talk about, much less show. And, you know, so Dribbble ends up being a place where we post the things we can show or the things we're working on. Mm-hmm. But, for someone so new to the digital, you know, product design field, I feel like, yeah, like your explanation makes a lot of sense, because my reaction was, holy shit, like there's some like real skill here. But, you know, and it's always hard for my position with young designers or, you know, people that are beginners to experience design, because it's really hard to gauge like what they're really good at. You know, some people might come in with more general skills, some very specific, like yours, like I think, the most noticeable thing is the visual design.
Yeah.
So my question to you is, in which order did you start to learn these skills? Like, if you were to look at visual design, experience design, information architecture, and all that kind of stuff, and mm-hmm. then research, like what's the order in which you've been learning those skills?
Yeah.
And are you focusing on all of them or, mm-hmm. or a subsection?
Yeah, that's a good question. So in terms of how I started out, I actually was one of those people who was afraid to start. And that's because I thought, well, I don't know what I'm doing. You know, I'm young. And so I would feel that I didn't focus on visual design at first. I didn't focus on the actual craft, right? I realized that, like, well, I really am intrigued by like psychology and behavioral economics and research and crafting experiences. And it was very, very people oriented and very, and so like, I just would read a lot and have conversations with people. And then I realized, you know, application, you know, especially if I wanted to get, you know, hired, frankly, it helps to have a very polished craft. So that's when I got serious about product design. That's when I focused on not just understanding what that all entails, but being able to deliver and execute on an actual craft. And so I began, like, literally, I didn't know what I was doing. I started in September, and I don't suggest this. I do believe in self-care and balance, and I need to, like, you know, practice my own words, but I literally burnt myself out, was not sleeping much, and in 4 months figured out how to do visual design well enough to get hired by the first agency. I had no idea what I was doing prior, but I mean, like, it's dedication. Like, I had to get a job, and I had to focus on my craft, my visual craft, not just having, like, head knowledge about, you know, experience design, information architecture, research processes, yeah, and everything. Like, it was about the craft and how I could apply what I learned to that and use that as a tool set, you know? So, yeah. I don't remember the second part of your question.
it doesn't even matter. What you're saying is interesting. About what does it take to get that first job? And I think it's very common that I think that some, especially in design, that first jobs are usually jobs in which, you know, a hiring manager can look at something very tangible and say, okay, yeah, mm-hmm, you have skill in that area. And then it seems like, as, you know, someone becomes more senior in their career, mm-hmm, that people start looking at the other things, like, well, how well can they read the room, you know, or convert, you know, business goals and user goals into ideas. And it's interesting because we have some beginner designers on our team that had a really hard time finding their first jobs. We saw the craft, but now it's interesting watching them, like, show the senior designers how to actually take those ideas about research and psychology and actually create deliverables that inspire a client and a team to actually do better design work. And it's really interesting when you can have those cultures of collaboration. Anyway, this is a side note. So, as someone that's relatively new to the design field, what have been some of your biggest challenges, mm-hmm, other than getting that first job?
Well, getting my first job was a challenge.
Yeah, I bet.
You know, I think finding support and mentorship. I was on my own, and I think that's why I'm so passionate about, you know, young people entering the industry who, especially, like, when not just comes to craft, but working your way around people and understanding people and that whole dynamic, right? Like, I just felt a little bit isolated. And of course, that's kind of comes with freelancing and, you know, working remotely with teams. So I think some of my challenges were I didn't have anyone to really turn to at first, if at least that's how it felt, in terms of, like, you know, at Grayson, like, these are the specific things that you need to focus on to improve mostly, like, your visual craft, you know, like, very specific things. But, like, honestly, like, you just supplement that with a shit ton of YouTube tutorials, and you find courses online and Skillshare and Treehouse. And if you stay cool and friendly and real, people are like happy to be your friends. And always, always find someone who's smarter than you and acknowledge that they're smarter than you, because you don't have your shit figured out, and that's okay. And I think you have to be willing to be honest with yourself about that. And, you know, be honest about that with others. You know, it's really awesome how people are excited to help you, you know, and to help others in the industry. You know, it should be supportive. It should be that collaborative, and, you know, so, yeah.
Yeah, it should be, you know. And there's, of course, some people that, you know, are very talented that never, like, leave their own house or never speak, never share anything. And they just kind of work in complete isolation, you know, and I guess, you know, that works for some people, but it doesn't work for everyone. It definitely makes it hard for young designers or even old fogies like me, like, learn new skills and think, mm-hmm, if we don't have ways to support each other. We don't necessarily have to be in the same room, but I agree that, like, having a support system is really important. Having a good mentor is critically important. And one-on-one time and stuff like that is also really important. And it's also really hard to learn how to do. What in your mind, what's the sort of ideal environment for a young designer to grow in? What is that collaboration? What does that mentorship look like? Like if you're speaking to all the agency owners out there, like what are some tips that you could give them to enhance the way that their people are supported and grown?
Well, I think that's a bit of a difficult question to answer for this reason. It's that not all agencies are equipped to have the resources or the investment to actually mentor someone who's very new and very young. And so, you know, when people, like, unless they're specifically hiring, like, for an internship with a set of expectations for what that looks like, when you hire a junior designer, they need consistent support and that kind of constant checking in and guidance. And so I feel that if you really, really care about this, if you care about, you know, because there are a lot of talented young people out there, correct? You know, like they've got the skill set, they've got the potential. Being able to not just recognize that and to value that, but also being willing to set aside, like, figure out a plan for what works within your company agency, and listening, honestly, like listen to what they need, you know, what are their struggles? And then of course, like, how does that align with, your business and your goals, and like creating kind of like a plan, honestly, that, you know, can benefit both and hopefully like accelerate their growth, you know? So I don't know if that answers your question. It's a hard question to answer because I didn't have that with the first two agencies that I worked with. And they were all very, for the most part, much more senior than I was and didn't know how to, really just, listen.
I think, and I could be wrong, but I think the companies that I've seen that seem to be the best at having, the real, really true programs for mentorship and training, seem to be the ones that have been around long enough to learn the lessons. Like a lot of the young companies, including Fundsize, I'll admit it, like, you know, Natalie and I are only not even five years into this. You know, we were just designers and all of a sudden we are having to learn how to run a studio. And so, we don't know the answers to this stuff too. We're trying to figure it out. But, you know, I will admit that, even though we have a very strong culture of collaboration, It's still really hard to make sure that we're doing all these things right. Cause I think, especially when everyone on the team is like a freaking like go-getter, right? Mm-hmm. It's very easy to like hire someone and accidentally forget to like not work with them on a regular basis to grow. Like, and then time flies, you know, and you just don't even realize it. And then like 6 months has gone by or something like that. And you realize, oh man, like I could have done way more mentoring, you know? It's hard, but yeah, I think it's really important.
Yeah, I think you definitely have a point. I think far more established companies, and often I think that like the product companies, you know, seem to focus a little bit more on you know, just creating like programs for people, you know, for the younger designers to grow and to develop, and then, you know, grow into like, you know, more mid-level, like senior positions in their company. But I mean, you guys are one of the first agencies that I know that cares about an actual mentorship program. Like, they're actively, and I'm sure there are many out there, but you're the one that comes to mind. Like, oh yeah, Fundsize. Like, you guys are figuring this out.
It's
a different line of work.
There's a lot of reasons, but there's really two reasons and they're both very different. One, for me personally, if I look back at my entire 17-year career being a designer, and I did have to do that one time. Like I was becoming a CEO and I was struggling with the fact that I was no longer making. And so I was reflecting on these 17 years and I went back to every job and every instance and I looked for common, threads. And I realized that almost all the time I had someone training very closely underneath me. It, you know, like it might've been my brother or Natalie. And I realized like, I'm not really doing all, like, I really was not doing all of the design work that I thought I was doing. I was like, I was identifying a certain skill in another designer and using that skill to my own advantage to pair with mine. And I didn't really realize this, but now I realize after looking back, I've never been a great, like, visual designer.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was, but I'm really not, you know, so I think that's just a common thread. Like, I just like training people. And, mm-hmm. When I'm retiring, the thing that I want to believe is that I trained a lot of great designers.
Yeah.
By the time that I'm 70 years old, I'm not going to care about any of the stupid, like, mobile apps or pieces of software mm-hmm. I'm designing today. I'm going to care about the people that, you know, I kind of want to play it forward.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is business-wise too. I mean, we're not some big company that has the luxury of just hiring senior people. And then even if you could, like, would you really want everyone to be the same? Like, if everyone had the same amount of background, came from design school and all were great, like, visual designers and, you know, all were, you know, white men and all, you know, like, you would just, there wouldn't really be any interesting work. So we like to have diversity in gender, age, background, training, job skills, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
It took us a while to get there, but it took us a while to get to a point where we could equally value, like, design research and visual design. But now we can pair those two people together and they have mirror skill sets. Yeah. So that's why we do it.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I'm not going to, you know, deny that the more balanced your team is in senior and beginner designers, the easier it is for a company to make their financial margins.
Mm-hmm. So. Yeah. Dude, I like kind of going back to what you were just saying a little bit earlier, like, I 100% resonate with, you know, how you're saying, like, kind of like stepping away from the design process and you're more in invested and actually enjoy, like, training people. I can see my own career kind of playing in that direction as well. Like, at the end of the day, what I worked on, what clients I worked on, whether, like, you know, I'll be proud of the work that I did, like, that won't matter so much to me as it will the people, you know, that I got an opportunity to connect with, to work with, to bring together. Like, I'm just, that's what I care about. And I realized that just in the past several months that I seem to be very driven in that direction. And though I think it's incredibly important, again, you know, especially if you're, say you're like in a management position, you know, you want to understand the craft, you want to be able to understand the people that you're leading, like, what they're doing. But, like, at the end of the day, like, I care about the people. I want to, you know, figure out ways to, like, bring people to work together and figure out ways where they can collaborate better and figure out those systems and those processes. Like, I care about that. That's, like, so, just something I'm so passionate about.
I wish that when I first went on my own freelancing, I was lucky enough to have a group of people that I could have done a collective model like you, because I think, I don't regret it, but mm-hmm. I think I had to learn a bunch of different things that were very different in order to survive freelancing. And if I had like a collaborative system like that, well thought out, I mean, it could have provided growth opportunities for me and maybe allow me to focus on a little bit more of narrow scope. But
I think why I'm excited about Wild and Grace, because it gives me that opportunity. Like, you learn from experience, right? Like, I can read all of the Medium posts I want on, like, team management and collaboration and whatever, but, like, at the end of the day, get your hands dirty. And so I think that's why I'm, like, so excited, like, to not know entirely what I'm doing, but to be excited and to be willing to fall, you know, fail and grow and have support and also just the drive and the will to just learn, you know, and learn how to work with people and learn to understand people better and learn how to provide them the opportunities that they're seeking, you know, for their own life. So,
yeah, I mean, you got a lot of great things going on and a really great head on your shoulders. And I love the way that you think about these things. And I'm glad that you're taking time out of your schedule to go and talk to people at you know, events and conferences and stuff like that. I didn't really start doing that until maybe 3 years ago. And even that, like, it's still very outside of my comfort zone. I can do this. Like, I can talk in front of a microphone, but man, in front of people, oh man, that's so, like, I don't think I'll ever get used to that. I mean, do you feel like a natural speaker?
Absolutely not. Dude, when I spoke at ValleyOcon, complete confession here, Here's what I end up doing, dude. I say yes to stuff I'm absolutely not qualified for or have zero experience in. And so public speaking is not one of those things that I ever thought I would be doing ever in my life. I'm shy. I'm an introvert. I love people, but like one-on-ones or just not like in the spotlight kind of thing. Right. Yeah. So I almost passed out when I was walking up to the stage to BattleCon. I like my vision got super blurry and my heart rate was like insane. But then after that, like after like, honestly, like the trauma of it, I was like, oh, I could do this again. You know, yeah. And then squares, definitely a little more comfortable, but like still, like, you know, like my second time in my life speaking, you know, you just say yes. I just say yes. I just said yes to another invitation to speak at a conference. Do I feel
today, well? Right? Like right before we started recording, I think.
No, a couple of days prior, oh, okay. But yeah. So it's the Creative Works conference I was talking about in Memphis. And so like, you just take it, you just do it, yeah. You know, you don't have to feel prepared. You never really fully are, you know, so... Yeah.
Well, if standing up in front of a crowd isn't hard enough, I don't know if this comes natural to you either, but creating a presentation deck is, I find, also very challenging. Yeah. And every time I do it, it ends up being like 300 slides. And then and then I try to read off of them, you know, like, I don't know how people do it where they just have like one slide and then they just like talk on, you know, like, I don't know, like I think it stresses me out when I do that because I feel like I have to be in sync with the slot. I don't know.
Like, no, I totally understand you. Like, honestly, I don't have a very fine-tuned process for like my creating like the slides and like, you know, having my talk prepped and everything. I'm just learning as I go. But for me, I realize like I cannot figure out how much time it actually takes to invest in creating slides. Yeah. And dude, I keep them simple AF, like, because I know that like I'm just eating up more time, like for ValueCon and for squares. Like I had months for squares, and I was still putting my deck together like the night before, and I told myself I wouldn't do that, but I think as like, you know, as I continue to do this more frequently, I guess I'll figure out what works. But yeah, the slides are hard for me.
Yeah.
Hard, you know.
There was one time Danielle Moser, a designer that's on my team, she mm-hmm. before she transitioned to being a designer, she was one of our first employees and she was a project manager, and her and I did a presentation at the digital project management summit. We had practices, we knew it, mm-hmm. but what happened the day of when we like launched the presentation in the room, it was the wrong version.
Oh gosh.
But we, you know,
what do you do?
we and luckily we had practiced it enough that we, you know, like, got over that. But yeah, that's an art in itself.
Oh yeah.
So, let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you talk about. I think, you know, you told me earlier that, the topic for your squares talk was called, what was it? By the people, for the people, or something like that.
Designing for real life.
For real life. So what, I mean, with, you know, you don't have to give us the whole thing, yeah. but what does this talk about?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like the gist of it was, I decided to do something less technical and just kind of focus on lessons learned through my little experience, in design and just working with, at that point, a couple different teams plus, you know, any contracted clients. And then I just focused on what I've learned about designing actually for people. So I shared basically how much I value, you know, the research process and also what it means. I think, like, you know, you hear the terminology like users tossed around fairly frequently, right? And for me, like, I understand it. That's kind of like the lingo that we use, you know, in tech. But just keeping in mind the humanity of the people that we're designing for. And so I tend to like to say people. Like, I don't just think of them, oh, users, you know, where yeah. you kind of put them in this category where, like, you know, it's just data, you know. And
that's
so
right.
I, for me, like, again, I get it. Like, I say user sometimes, but just at the heart of it, at the core of it, like, what does it mean to have a human-centric approach to design? What does it mean to keep, you know, users or people as the North Star, you know, just remembering, like, I'm designing for a human. And then also, like, I'm really interested and fascinated by the topic of empathy. And it's something that we hear very frequently, obviously, in tech, and it's obviously a buzzword, and maybe it's a little bit of a cliche thing. Like you say empathy and people are like, oh yeah, well, I know what that is. But I've been exploring this concept of emotional empathy versus cognitive empathy and like the differences and how to like use both or use honestly focusing on cognitive empathy. So the quick version is emotional empathy. Emotional transference, you know, you're in distress, you're in pain. I see that, especially as I identify as an empath. I feel what you're feeling. And, you know, so often we're told, you know, you should be in people's shoes to understand what they're going through, to be able to really, truly relate. And, I understand where that argument's coming from. And I think there's an appropriate time and place for that. But also realizing that, especially for people who are empaths or people who tend to take on the burden of someone else's emotions, you know, that's, leads to burnout. It's an exhausting process. And maybe it may not always be the best approach to understanding where someone's coming from, especially if you're using it as a tool for research. And so, I first heard of cognitive empathy through, Indy Young, who, actually lives out in the, San Francisco. And I started doing just a lot of research. Like there's various resources on this, but using cognitive empathy as a tool for research and understanding that even though emotional empathy is a great thing in some aspects, being able to empathize and to feel someone, you I've heard Helen Tran say this, but I think she might have possibly taken it from someone else.
Oh, she's great.
She's amazing. I love Helen. Yeah. You basically don't have to drown to save someone who's drowning. Like you don't have to feel what that's like, you know, to save someone. And that's such a valid point, and it makes so much sense to me. And so I just kind of explored what cognitive empathy is, and that's sort of a process where you do not have to feel, you know, per se, what someone else is feeling to truly understand. You can figure out a way to kind of get to the heart of who they are through like a very simple step, and that's listening. And the really neat thing about listening is that it's listening without ego, without bias. It's listening without thinking that you have to interject your opinion, your thoughts, or like to prove something. Because if you think about it, like so frequently when we are in conversation, and someone's like sharing their thoughts, we're not always like actually like taking it in without bias. Like we want to like project our values, you know, interrupt them and prove a point or just like comment, you know? And so the beautiful thing about cognitive empathy is that it takes not doing that, like shut up, and understand that this person has expectations, biases, opinions, feelings, and taking all of that in so that you can aggregate all of that insights later and kind of approach it. You know, where I guess I just see it's more of an intellectual approach, honestly. And again, the idea is you don't have to emotionally feel to understand and to care. And then I, you know, kind of led that into compassion. There's a guy named Paul Bloom. He's a cognitive scientist and psychologist, I believe from Yale. And he's actually, and I say this in quotes, against empathy, just for the reasons I was explaining before. It's a very exhausting exercise, you know, feeling what other people are feeling. And so he translates that into like, how do we understand compassion? You know, how can we use compassion as a tool or as a method for really gaining the deeper insights that we need, especially with research when we're designing for people. And so like, I love the idea of compassion because it's unconditional in a way, you know, it's real. Like I look at you, Anthony, and I see you for who you are. And I don't have the kind of, I see your inherent worth. Basically, I see your value and that matters. And I can implement that to gain whatever insights I need. And I really thought it was really interesting because Paul Bloom, in one of his articles, he wrote about cognitive empathy kind of being cold-blooded. And I understand where he's coming from that, because if you're using it simply as a tool to like almost, this is like, you know, I don't know if there's a proper way to say this, but like manipulate someone in a good way, you know, to gain, you know, insights and data, you know, that it seems a little like manipulative. Like I get that perspective. And so he has a good argument. I would recommend people like just to delve into that more. But like I love the idea of compassion because again, it's about recognizing someone's inherent worth and their value and seeing them for who they truly are and being able to just set aside your own biases, your own opinions, and embrace them, because people are so different. It really takes understanding people's like backgrounds and the, you know, advocating for diversity. Like this is kind of where that comes into play, you know, and being open to that, and just understanding like people are people and we all have a commonality of wanting to be valued, to be appreciated. We need to advocate for more vulnerability and transparency, you know, and making people feel that they can do that. You know, that's the cool thing about cognitive empathy. It's that you can make someone feel safe to share, and it doesn't have to be a cold-blooded tactic. It's just understanding that that's what we want, you know, deep down inside. We want to be able to share our lives and be open and vulnerable, know that someone cares and is listening. We don't necessarily need you to feel what we're feeling. We just want you to be there. And so I think that's, it's, you know, it's a great, you know, opportunity, you know, to kind of practice that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting. That gives me some things to, I think that I can learn. I mean, I've never honestly heard the term
cognitive empathy.
Cognitive empathy. Yeah. I'm going to check that out.
Yeah.
I mean, but I think that I might kind of already be doing that without really thinking about it. Like, because I'm so used to running a business and working with clients, I don't just look at the people that are using the products I'm designing. I also have to understand the client. And so I do these like client personas, like either in my own head or in my notepad or whatever, because sometimes like in another layer of this, and back to the fact that we're working with people, sometimes the people that hire us just want their boss to stop screaming at them and like being like giving them this one design thing, even if it's something that you don't like. If you give that person that thing, their boss might stop screaming at them. And will help them in some way other than actually helping the person that would be using the tool. I like to look at all those things, like all the people that are around the work, you know, because it's not always, it's mostly about designing good products, I think. otherwise I wouldn't do this. But if, you know, you and I are both kind of the same, I think we think about the people that we're working with, and I want to be able to know that I help solve their problem in their organization or in their culture, not just do design a great piece of software. I think about that kind of stuff too.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think more people should, you know, it's not just your team, but who you're working with and understand the context of where they're coming from.
Yeah.
You know, that's so important. That's so important. Yeah.
I mean, just on a side note, but I think openness is really important, because designers are, I mean, not all of us, but some of us tend to be sensitive, and it's our work. Like, it's very personal, right? Like, it's hard for it to not be personal sometimes. You know, like, we spend all this time working on this thing, and when people don't react to it well, or like heavily criticize it, or quite blatantly say like, "I just don't like that," it hurts sometimes. Yeah. You know, but I think you can ask questions or have the conversations that help get to the bottom of that. Like, we were working with a big Bay Area client and was with one of our young designers. This designer said, like, "I don't think the client likes me or any of the work that I'm doing." I was like, why would you think that? Well, so they like keep saying this stuff. I'm like, well, maybe you just haven't asked the right question yet. Like, maybe have you asked the question, like, how much should I be pushing to really radicalize a change in paradigm shift here, versus just do quick work that you can test? And it turns out that the answer was, we really want you to push on this thing over here, but not on this one, you know? And I think once this designer realized that he could ask some of these questions, it became a tool for him to start asking those things earlier on, so that he can build that connection with the client, provide a service to that client, provide solutions that are going to meet the needs the best. And I think, I don't know why I mentioned that. I think it just, I guess I was trying to talk about openness and just asking those kinds of questions.
No, I think I understand where you're coming from, and the importance of being able to feel that you can step up and say, "Hey," you know, and ask a clarifying question to gain the insights and the directions that you need. Like, I remember working with a client, and it was so interesting to me. We were working with the client, and there's a few people on the project, and the client kept saying something like, "We don't like this. We don't like this." and please stop doing this. And for some reason, it just wasn't translating in each iteration of work that we would present to them. Like, it was still appearing. And so there is a moment where I was talking with one of the people on the project that we were working with from the client side, and we were kind of just going over their designs, and we came to that section where, again, they were like, we don't like this. And so I realized, I was like, you know what? Look, has anybody asked why? It's a really simple question. Why? And so, I phrased it a little bit more specifically, but I later found out that they simply felt that they had used this type of design and their prior branding, and it felt outdated, and they didn't understand why we kept using it. Because the truth was that what we were doing was not necessarily outdated, but it felt dated for them, and it wasn't translating that we were understanding where they were coming from. We never asked why. So I just think it's really important to never be afraid to ask questions. You know, like, what do you have to lose? You know, it doesn't make you look ignorant. It shows that you care, that you're intentional, you know.
Yeah. And isn't that our primary job as a designer, to ask
absolutely.
Why?
Absolutely. Yes. My favorite question, dude. Why?
Yeah. Awesome. So what's next for you? I mean, where do you hope to, what do you hope to accomplish this year? And
well, so basically the next couple of months, I'm going to be probably working for the most part, like in terms of like living situation out in San Francisco still. Really honestly, just focusing on building my brand, learning how to build a team, learning how to manage that, figuring out just a little bit more of the detail of the model that we're pursuing, and just getting our work out there.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for taking time.
Oh, thank you.
We didn't even get to tell of the audience about how long it took for us to get a recording
time.
Going on. And it's a funny story. You'll have to ask Grayson about what happened the last time we tried to record. How can people find you?
Yeah, like your best bet is probably to tweet at me. I love Twitter. It's my friend. So you can find me at Grayson Sophia, and that's Grayson with an E and Sophia with an F. Same on Instagram if you want to see some of the stuff that I post and kind of get a peek into my life through Insta stories. So yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for tuning into the Hustle Podcast. We'll see you next time. Hustle is made by Funsize, a digital design agency that works with inspiring product teams around the world. Learn more about us at funsize.co. This season of Hustle is brought to you by Design Inc., the best place to find creative talent and receive free proposals for your project. Go to designink.com/hustle and get started today. If you're a designer and you'd like to join, you can apply at designink.com/apply. Also, thanks to Graveyard Teeth for the music and Black River Audio for mixing the show.